sarstim vyasam tojaya mudirayat nasta praishu abhadreshu nityang bhagavata sevaya bhagavat bhagavati yute bhakti bhavati naistiki Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. Struggling to find my glasses. Oh, I've got them. It's okay. Do they make me look learned? Good. At least I look learned. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Reading today from Canto 10, Chapter 87, Verse Number 1. Should I read the introduction to the chapter? I think I should. Let me read the introduction. We've just finished, obviously, Chapter 86. This is Chapter 87, The Prayers of the Personified Vedas. This chapter presents the prayers by the personified Vedas glorifying the personal and interpersonal aspects of Lord Narayan. King Parikshit asked Srila Shuka Goswami how the Vedas can directly refer to the Supreme Absolute Truth, Brahman, since the Vedas deal with the material realm governed by the three modes of nature, and Brahman is completely transcendental to these modes. In reply, Shukadeva Goswami described an ancient encounter between Sri Narayan Rishi and Narada Muni at Badarikashram. Traveling to that sacred hermitage, Narada found the Lord surrounded by exalted residents of the nearby village of Kalapa. After bowing down to Narayan Rishi and his associates, Narada submitted the same question to him. In reply, Narayan Rishi related an account of how this very question had once been discussed long ago among the great sages living in Janaloka. One of these sages, feeling inquisitive about the nature of the Absolute Truth, chose Sanandana. How do you pronounce that? Sanandana Kumara, to speak on this subject. Sanandana told them how the numerous personified Vedas, appearing as the first emanations from the breathing of Lord Narayan, recited prayers for his glorification just before the creation. Sanandana then proceeded to recite these elaborate prayers. The residents of Janaloka were perfectly satisfied upon hearing Sanandana recite the prayers of the personified Vedas, which enlightened them about the true nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth, and they honored Sanandana with their worship. Narada Muni was equally satisfied to hear this account from Sri Narayana Rishi. Thus Narada offered his obeisances to the Lord and then went to see his disciple, Veda Vyas, to whom he explained everything he had heard. There's a lot of conversations within conversations here. This is the, this is the oral tradition of how the Vedic knowledge was passed down. Today we think this is very primitive. But actually, it was a very great tradition, the oral tradition. We think that if one is illiterate, that is a great sign of misfortune, as it may be in a way today. But there were great advantages to that tradition. We'll discuss that a little bit, actually, the oral tradition. Very, very important. We're reading today from the first verse. Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritaya Katam Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritayaha Katang Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pure Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritayaha Katang Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanya Dineshe Negune Gunavritayaha Katang Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritayaha Katam Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritayaha Katang Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare. Ladies, please. Shri Parikshit Uvacha Brahman Brahmanyane Deshye Negune Gunavritayaha Katang Charanti Shrutaya Sakshat Sadasatak Pare Shri Parikshit Uvacha Shri Parikshit said Brahman O Brahmana Shukadev Brahmani in the absolute truth Anirdeshe which cannot be described in words. Nirgune, which has no qualities. Guna, the qualities of material nature. Vritayaha, whose scope of action. Katam, how. Charanti, function, by referring. Shrutayaha, the Vedas, Sakshad, directly, Sat, to material substance, Asataha, and its subtle causes, Pare, in that which is transcendental. Translation, Shri Parikshit said, O Brahman, How can the Vedas directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth, who cannot be described in words? The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature, but the Supreme is devoid of these qualities, being transcendental to all material manifestations and their causes. Please repeat after me. Shri Parikshit said, O Brahman, how can the Vedas directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth, who cannot be described in words? The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature, but the Supreme is devoid of these qualities. Being transcendental to all material manifestations and their causes. Purport. It's a long purport, so I'm only going to read half of it. Before beginning his commentary on this chapter, Srila Sridhar Swami prays, Vagisha yasya vadane lakshmi yasya chivakshasi yasyaste hridaye sangvit tang nishinka mahang bhaje. I worship Lord Nishinga, within whose mouth reside the great masters of eloquence, upon whose chest resides the goddess of fortune, and within whose heart resides the divine potency of consciousness. Sampradaya Vishudyartang Sviya Nirbanda Yantritaha Shruti Stuti Mitavyakyang Karisyami Yatamati. Desiring to purify my sampradaya and being bound by duty, I will briefly comment on the prayers of the personified Vedas to the best of my realization. Srimad Bhagavatam Purvai Sharataksa Nisevitam Mayatu Tadupas Pristam Uchistam Upachiyate. Inasmuch as the Srimad Bhagavatam has already been perfectly honored by my predecessors' explanations, I can only gather together the remnants of what they have honored. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti offers his own invocation, Mama Ratna Venig Bhavang Ratna Yapa Parichinvataha Hasantu Santu Jiremi Nasvasvanta Vinodakrit. The saintly devotees may laugh at me for becoming a jewel merchant, though I know nothing about precious jewels. But I feel no shame, for at least I may entertain them. Do we have any jewel merchants here? Namesti vaidasyapi napi bhaktir virakti raktir natatapi lolyat sadurgamad eva bhavami veda stutyarta chintamani rasi gridnahu. Though I have no wisdom, devotion, or detachment, I am still greedy to take the philosopher's stone of the Vedas' prayers from the fortress in which it is being kept. Ma nichatayam avivake vayu pravatite pata yitam balachchet. Likham yatak swami sanatan shri krishnangri bastamba kritavalamba. If the wind of indiscretion, my failure to acknowledge my lowly position, threatens to knock me down, then while writing this commentary, I must hold on to the effulgent pillars of the feet of Sridhar Swami, Sanatan Goswami, and Lord Shri Krishna. Sounds a bit like a mixed metaphor, doesn't it? The effulgent pillars of the feet. I guess the feet include the ankles. Otherwise, it would be a bit mixed between the horizontal and the vertical. But anyway, interesting metaphor there. Pranamya Shri Gurum Bhuya Shri Krishna Karunavanavam Lokanatam Jagatchakshu Shishukam Taduparaye. Repeatedly bowing down to my divine spiritual master and to Lord Shri Krishna, the ocean of mercy, I take shelter of Shishuka Goswami, the protector of the world and its universal eye. That finishes the invocations. We've just got a few more sentences, so please bear with me. At the end of the preceding chapter, Shukadev Goswami told Parikshit Maharaj, Evang Sva Bhaktayo Rajan Bhagavan Bhakta Bhaktiman Ushidva Dishyasan Margang Punadvaravatim Magat. Thus, O King, the personality of Godhead, who is the devotee of his own devotees, stayed for some time with his two great devotees, teaching them how perfect saints behave. Then he returned to Dvarka. Omagyana Timurandasya Janandana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Paditanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhaktivinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. I'm going to try and explore how this verse and purport is relevant to us all. After all, the Vedic knowledge is not meant to be like we had. I used to live in Oxford. They'd call it the ivory towers approach. One would be a philosopher living in one's ivory tower, and very little benefit would be felt by the man in the street. You've heard that ivory tower approach? The Vedic knowledge isn't like that. It's actually meant for the welfare of others. There is a wonderful phrase at the start of the Srimad Bhagavatam where truth is defined. Their truth is defined as knowledge differentiated from illusion for the welfare of all. Is that right? Knowledge or truth differentiated from illusion for the welfare of all? Very interesting definition. How knowledge is actually meant to help ourselves and others. There's one very nice quote that I'm going to read from a lecture from Srila Prabhupada. It was here in Mumbai. It says here Bombay, so I guess it was a few years ago, 1973, where he says, he's speaking about the six Goswamis. And I quote, they were practicing in order to teach us. Simple teaching will not do. We must also practice. Simply quoting verses like a parrot will be of little benefit. That analogy of a parrot is used elsewhere, but the analogy is not used in this sense, that a parrot simply repeats what it hears. It has another meaning, which is alluded to already in some of the invocation, actually. But Srila Prabhupada says that very clearly, that theoretical knowledge is not enough. One must apply them. Vigyana, vigyana, sahitang. Jnana means to know, and vigyana means to apply this knowledge in practical life. Jnana vigyana sahitang. So we must know the vigyan, how to practically apply this knowledge. This was taught by the Goswamis. So I'm going to try and actually explore this verse and see how it's relevant to us. In one sense, much of what's been discussed here is linked to epistemology. Have you heard the word epistemology? Oh dear. I see a few nods. Epistemology is the science, is the philosophy that looks at how we attain knowledge. Epistemology. It's one of the four branches of Western... Are you in a philosophical mood? I hope so. I really do hope so. Because this is going to get heavy. But please, bear with me. I have a liking for philosophy for some reason. But this purport is very philosophical. And actually, when I read it, I was really concerned how I was going to speak. But then I saw that the second half of the purport is really philosophical. So whoever speaks next is really going to have to look at it. But I want to look at this because sometimes Indian philosophy is not credited in the West as much as it should be. And I think this is important for us to look at. In Western philosophy, there are four branches. Logic, epistemology, which is the science of how we get knowledge. Metaphysics, which is really talking about the big questions, and it's related to ontology. It's about, more or less, it's about the concepts that we have in the Bhagavad Gita. The self, the super self, the world, and so on. It involves the truths we have. And then the fourth one is ethics. I'd like to say a little bit about ethics because it's an interesting subject. And if we have time, we will actually discuss that a little bit. Because there is a big question in academic circles now as to whether there is such a thing as Hindu ethics. And I'm going to propose that actually those of us who are members of the Hare Krishna movement, those of us who are actually following some form of the Vedic or Hindu tradition, and those of us who live in India need some ethics at the moment. Sorry, I don't mean to be critical. But the view that we get of India culturally is not so favorable at the moment. I'm not saying, of course, that there's not moral issues in my own country, in the UK. There are very serious moral issues and moral discussions. But also here, in the UK, India is still celebrated for its spirituality. That's a fact. People know that sometimes we talk about the global village. You know, we live in a modern age where there's a lot of communications and the world is becoming very small. Have you heard that term, the global village? It's still recognized by many people that India is the place for spirituality. But I'd like to look at the issue of ethics as well, because that may be important if we have time. So there are four branches of philosophy. Who's remembered them? Raise your hands. Brilliant. Could you say them, Damodar? Logic. Very good. Epistemology. Metaphysics. And ethics. Yes. It's interesting because within the Hindu tradition, within the philosophy, they're very much merged together. We have almost a kind of monism there. And I would like to propose, as we discuss it, there is a need for us, as members of this organization, particularly those of us who are teachers and preachers, to actually begin to separate out some of those disciplines. And Srila Prabhupada, and I'd like to make this point quite strongly, and we'll come to this, he was very critical of what he called churchianity. Have you heard some on lectures? There's some lectures he didn't like. There's one lecture I've got where he actually said, this Krishna consciousness movement is not a religion. And I would like to discuss that because it is very important that we don't become too religious, please. And I want to explain that a little bit. What I mean by that, and what Srila Prabhupada means by that. But when he mentions that, he makes that point, he says that actually our Krishna consciousness theology should be able to speak on all subjects according to all the academic disciplines. Sociology, psychology, the science of leadership, education, business. Otherwise, what is the benefit of this Krishna consciousness movement? If I tell you, I can tell you how to chant Hare Krishna, but I can't teach you anything else. Srila Prabhupada didn't actually want that. And I think I'd like to discuss that a little bit. Are you feeling comfortable with what I'm saying? You are. Or you're meant to feel a little uncomfortable. In the Vedic method of teaching, there's anuloma and pratiloma. Sometimes you go with the grain, sometimes you go against the grain. I like to go against the grain, you may have noticed. It is good. How is this relevant to us? I'd like to actually discuss it a little bit personally. Also connected to outreach. And I'd like to also just, if we've got time, briefly discuss the role of ethics in all of this. And I'd also like to conclude with one verse from the Vedas that actually shows that bhakti is actually there in the Vedas, despite what is said about the Vedas. I'm assuming here we're talking about the four Vedas and the Karmakanda section. I'm not sure. Although in the Vedas there is also the Upanishads. They're part of the Veda, I think, yes. So I'm assuming here we're talking more about Karmakanda, because here it said the Vedas deal with this world. Although there's mention of Brahman. But not a lot of discussion about what it is, rather more what it isn't. We'll come to that. If I say anything wrong, will you pandits please tell me? Please. Please. Thank you. One of the problems with the path of logic is that naturally one tends to come to the impersonal concept because we negate this world. And by that process of negation, not this, not that, one can actually begin to understand Brahman just. So that's called, in Latin, that's called via negativa. You try to define in terms of spirit, in terms of what it is not, according to our experience. But it seems that the natural conclusion from the path of Jnana Yoga, and I'm not going to particularly decry Jnana Yoga, it's very important, even though as bhakti yogis, we actually favor bhakti over jnana. I was actually, just before I came, I had some correspondence with one academic in the UK, and I wrote to him that one commentator has said that when you try and extract the idea that jnana yoga is the highest from the Gita, you kind of have to twist the text a little bit. It's quite a strained interpretation. He responded to me that many academics have said that it seems quite clear that Krishna, yoginam apisarvesham mudgateinantaratmanah, at the end of the sixth chapter, he says that bhakti is the highest. But we have to understand that very carefully, and therefore Lord Krishna goes into detail about the other types of yoga. And it isn't just so that we can then completely kick them out, by the way. We have to be careful of that. I'm not going to get into that too much now, but we need to be careful. But the point is that generally, by that process of speculation or scholarship, one tends to come to the idea, if there is an absolute truth, and this is a big debate in philosophy, that usually the concept is monism. There is no variety within that absolute truth. And that is prevalent. I'll come to that later, because also in the West, in the UK, that was amongst academics and general people, and even school children are taught about Hinduism, that is the idea that's taught to them, that actually, I mean, don't get me going about some of the school textbooks we've got in the UK about Hinduism. Please. Hindus believe in a god whom they call Brahman. They have statements like that. I don't know, but do you Hindu people, let me check now I'm here in Mumbai, do you call God Brahman? Do you hear others calling God Brahman? What do you call God? Whatever tradition you're from. Bhagavan. Yes. And that's not just with Vaishnavs either. That extends. Yes? Am I right? Thank you. Yes, Bhagavan. So there's a very strange concept. Of course, Brahman means the absolute truth. Sometimes that is equated with God, sometimes not. But it's a different term. Let me move on a little bit. What I'm going to say here is that even though, as Bhakti Yogis, we actually do not follow the path of Jnana Yoga. That is not the means. The means is Bhakti. However, I will say that that doesn't mean that we reject logic or knowledge. Otherwise, why are we having this class? That's not the case. And Srila Prabhupada, when he actually describes the Uttama Adhikari, we have the Kanishtha, the Madhyam, the Uttama Adhikari. Excuse me. He says, an advanced devotee situated on the platform of spontaneity. That's the highest platform. One has that spontaneous attraction for Krishna. At the moment, we're following sadhana bhakti. We have to preach ourselves to do what we have to do. Actually, I remember when I joined ISKCON, and that was in 1973, I used to wake up in the morning at about 4 o'clock, and I had to preach myself out of the sleeping bag. What am I doing here in the Hare Krishna temple? Oh, yes. And I should get up. And so I'd kind of preach to myself. You've had that experience? But spontaneity comes later, where there's natural attraction. An advanced devotee situated on the platform of spontaneity is already very expert in shastric instruction, logic, and argument. So we shouldn't think that actually coming to the path of bhakti yoga is a kind of ticket to becoming illogical. No. That still needs to be there. And of course, there are many flaws in the... If we start to look at the conclusion, the monist conclusion, there are many flaws in that argument, logically, actually. Yeah. Or at least if one studies Shastra, there's many flaws. I won't go into all of them now, but even in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna first rebukes, he scolds Arjuna. Yeah? Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Ashochana Vashosha Twang Pragyavadang Shibasase Gatasu Nagatasun Cha Nanushochanti. What's the last verse? Pandit. Oh, Pandita. Yes, of course. A pandit never laments, right? You're talking like a learned. So he's rebuked Arjuna. And what is that source of the implicit in there? Is the source of his lamentation, which is identification with the material body. Because as soon as you identify with the body, then there will be lamentation. And the opposite, Brahmabhuta, Prasanatma, Nashokchiti, Nakanchiti. As soon as one is Brahman realized, then there's no lamentation. So we all know what lamentation is. Yeah. Yeah, we have experience. We have some realization, I think. Yeah. Yes, good. At least we're beginning. Yes. So Krishna's already condemned the bodily concept of life. Then in the next verse, na tveva hang jatu na shang na tveng na me janadipa na chaiva na bhavishavak sarvivang atakparam. Did I get that right? My memory's going. Never was very interesting, and I think this is, I'd like to get into, I don't think we have a lot of time, to discuss how Krishna teaches, because it's really exemplary. He doesn't start with, I'm God, and here are a few commandments, thou shalt. He actually begins with a sense of immediacy, and he begins with the self. And he kind of, that sense of immediacy of the context is there. He's talking about, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, Arjuna, nor all of these soldiers. Very interesting way of teaching, actually. So he's using a plurality of selves. He's saying, there's myself, Arjuna, you're there, and there's lots of soldiers here. Plural. So the argument is that if actually all the souls and the Supreme Lord are simply some kind of, or that diversity is simply a projection of the human mind onto the one Brahman, why does Krishna then use that multiplicity? You, me, them. Interesting argument. And there are lots of arguments. There's one tape I've heard where Srila Prabhupada is arguing about three words. Nitya yukta upasate, which means the devotees eternally worship the Lord. Now, worship is one thing. For worship to take place, there must be an object of the worship and there must be a worshipper. Yeah? So there are three things. The worship, and there must be the worshipper, and that which is worshipped or the focus of worship. Therefore, they're distinct. Nitya yukta, they eternally worship, which means those three things are eternally distinct, which means that the self is eternally distinct from the Supreme Self. Just three words. So there are lots of arguments, and we should actually start to become, as if we're going to reach out, we need to actually become proficient in some of these arguments. Yeah. And after a while, we may even start to think logically that being a personalist is far more logical, actually, in a sense. It makes more sense. Actually, that's how I feel anyway. It makes a lot more sense. Let me move on. However, I'd just like to say there is a tendency for us to sometimes, well, in the beginning of spiritual life, to fall into the trap of impersonalism. Now, I think it's a bit tricky because I don't think anyone here, at least those of us who are Vaishnavas here, will say, I believe in an impersonal absolute. But there may be ways in which we tend to actually demonstrate a tendency for that impersonal philosophy. Not just in relationship to God, but in relationship to the self and in relationship to the world. So we need to be careful about that. Are we becoming impersonal? And I don't mean that I know what happens in ISKCON. We have some very interesting use of language here. That Prabhu, I don't know your name. Gopinath Chandra Prabhu. If you actually did something to me that upset me, like you told me your class wasn't very good, I'd be very upset. If you did something like that, I might say, if I criticize, Prabhu, you're being impersonal. Or you don't treat me nice. I know why we use the word impersonal. It's got that connotation, you're a follower of Shankaracharya. And actually, Srila Prabhupada refutes this. He says, because we're personalists, we have arguments. Actually, so I don't mean necessarily like that, although there is a case for saying that we need to have those good exchanges between each other, and if we have time to come to ethics, I'd like to discuss that, those loving exchanges, because they're a very important part of ethics. But sometimes the tendency to renounce to deny the self, we think sometimes that if I can deny my material personality, I will somehow come to my spiritual identity. But that doesn't work. We are who we are materially as well as spiritually. We have a particular material identity. We have a particular conditioning. And if one tries to deny one's material identity, that doesn't lead us to realization of our spiritual identity, that path of negation. And some of us may have tried that. Perhaps even we take on the role of, when we join the Hare Krishna movement, we speak in a certain way, we dress in a certain way. Even we may try and hide our personality. Yeah? Because we think, well, I speak for myself, my own personality often is not very Krishna conscious. So we try and hide ourselves. I will put on the persona of a saint. I will speak in a certain way. Does it work? No. We remain who we are. Yeah. We keep that. So this trying to deny the self, and sometimes our needs, doesn't work. Therefore, that path of impersonal realization is really troublesome. Believe me, I've tried giving up desires. Yes? Of course, we have to struggle sometimes with material desires. That's fine. But in the end, if we're always struggling with my material desires, it's not going to be very fruitful. Why? Because the self, and this is very important, is the source of our desires. You do not find desire in a dead stone or a corpse. I'm going to read something I wrote on this. Let me just read this. Sometimes we also condemn wealth. Yeah? But here it's mentioned that on the chest of Lord Narasingadev sits the goddess of fortune. Let me read something on this. We claim we fear Maya, darkness and failure. But are we not more fearful of our true glory and opulence, of our true identity, of light and success? We claim we fight bondage, but are we not terrified of liberty? Some philosophers have written about this. Jean-Paul Sartre said that we're all afraid because we've got to make decisions in this world. Of the natural freedom to which we are truly heir. I'm sorry, the language is a little poetic. To poor wretches, does not freedom seem a burden? Does not the caged bird, once released, happily hop back into his cage, into the confines of his cage? Does not the recently released criminal pine for prison life with his bosom friends, the comfort of a padded cell, and the reassurance of a daily routine? Sometimes prisoners purposely commit a crime so they can go back in. They like it. They have their sangha. I've actually seen it because I was in prison. Just to let you know who I am. For selling books and having kirtan. And we saw some of the life in there. And the kind of things they talk about. Who's in, who's out. I won't get into it. It's a particular kind of mode of conversation. And does not the world renouncer prefer his cloistered existence? And what of desire? Why condemn it? Is aspiration not a function of spirit? It is certainly not found in stone, dust, or the unblinking corpse. Hence, wise men state that those who deny the spirit through the path of negation. This is the problem. When you deny this world, you can also not only deny or negate matter, but you negate spirit. Because the Bhagavatam says this world is a mixture of matter and spirit. The danger is we deny spirit, not the self. So we look, we see there's personhood. We've got a certain psychophysical nature. Therefore we say spirit cannot have that. Not necessarily. Where does your form come from? Our physical form comes from the subtle body. Yeah? The process of transmigration. So whatever is the state of that subtle body at death, almost like, you know, like when you have iron filings, they show the shape of a magnetic field. Similarly, matter, gross matter, clings to us and it shows what type of person we have. Yes? So you can see, even now as you look at my features, you can tell what I am. I've got a very protruding chin. That means I'm determined, but I also get angry very easily. I was born on Mahashivratri, by the way. That's true. I was, so watch out. Hence, wise men state that those who deny the spirit through the path of negation are reborn as stones and pebbles. For are their hearts not as hard as clubs, and their words more lethal than words? Actually, Srila Prabhupada says in one tape, sometimes we criticize the Mayavadis. Srila Prabhupada says that. That's a very English way of saying things. Sometimes we criticize the Mayavadis. But he says that the Jnana Yogis, they're more advanced. But in another sense, that path of Jnana, of renunciation, is sometimes more dangerous than the path of Bhakti. Sorry, the path of Karma. It is sometimes because one's heart becomes hard. And when one's heart becomes hard, it is very difficult to appreciate the glories of the Supreme Lord and to receive His mercy. So in some ways it's better to be a Karmi than a staunch Jnani or renouncer, because one's heart becomes hard. And that's why the Shastra says they can be born as stones. It says, if you're so envious of the Supreme Lord that you deny Him. So one needs to understand this properly, how it's quite, it's not just we've got an argument with the Jnanis or the Mayavadis. It's to do with what goes on psychologically and so on, spiritually. And are that not their words more lethal than swords? Here's an interesting part. And what of opulence? Why do you deride prosperity? Is it not because you crave it, as the fox desires the grapes lately perceived as sour? Why do you criticize the rich? Are they not deserving of divine love? Where now has your equality gone? What will you do when you meet the goddess of fortune? So sometimes if we take to that path of renouncing the world, we may criticize wealth. Why? What's the problem? Srila Prabhupada talks about this on one lecture. He talks about the phrase Daridra Narayan, to refer to a sadhu who is also God, but he's just poor. And Srila Prabhupada then said, why should we favor the poor? What have the rich done that they can't be glorified by the Lord? Very interesting. So we need to be very, very careful. Our path is not that path of negation. Let me read just a little more. Rejoice in the true self and become situated in your true glory. How will you see your true faith if you negate everything beautiful? If you cannot appreciate the beauty of this world, albeit transient, how will you appreciate its creative womb, its source of sustenance, and its ultimate resting place? Why try to pretend? This girl is not beautiful. This boy is not handsome. Have you become so spiritually blind? So there is that attraction. But then we try to say, oh, there's no beauty. Of course, the beauty comes from the self, again. Srila Prabhupada, sometimes he would when he saw a kirtan, he would see some ladies dancing. He said, take a picture. They're very beautiful. Beauty is, we can't deny the beauty. It's there. Have you become so spiritually blind, condemning the cloud, even if it is black, hardly glorifies the sun? I go on a little bit, but there is a tendency in the beginning of spiritual life to actually deny the self, to deny the world. But that is not our path. And I'm going to read something here just before we finish. A quote, if I can find it. I was having a conversation with one devotee, and we were discussing whether we should be fearful of Maya. What do you think? What are your answers? Should we be fearful of Maya? Should we? Yes. What do you mean by Maya? Maya means absence of Krishna. Something else? The illusion, that which is not. In that sense, yes, but Maya also refers to energy. Should we be afraid of the material energy? Why? No, why not? Why should we be fearful? It's Krishna's world. I'll read this. I know in India there are many foolish persons who think that by reading Bhagavad Gita, one is apt to renounce the world. This is complete foolishness. Srila Prabhupada is a sadhu. You know how a Brahmin speaks and a Kshatriya speaks? Kshatriya has a heart like fire or like a sword, but his words are like honey. And a Brahmin, his heart is very soft, but sometimes his words are sharp. Therefore, when a Brahmin came, this is in the Udyoga Parva of the Mahabharata, a Brahmin came to seek peace from Bhishma Dev. And Bhishma Dev said, I know what you're saying is true, but your words are really heavy. I guess it's because you're a Brahmin. Arjuna was a family man, a soldier, and he was directly taught the principles of Bhagavad Gita, but he never renounced the world nor the battlefield. In fact, the whole purpose of the Gita was to tell him not to renounce. We haven't got time to discuss it. I do not know why there are certain crazy men who think like that if a man becomes a devotee, he will have no more interest in material, in worldly affairs. I'm going to read that again. That if a man becomes a devotee, he will have no more interest in worldly affairs. Of course, that has to be understood properly. But still, we have an interest. A different interest, perhaps. We are not Mayavadi. We do not state that this world is false. We say that if Krishna is truth, the world is also truth, because the world is a manifestation of Krishna's energy. So if Krishna is true, how can his energy be false? We say Maya is true, and because it is Krishna's energy, she must be employed in Krishna's service. That is our philosophy. I don't have time to go on. I was going to discuss a lot. Do I have 5 minutes just for a question or two? Have I got to finish? Wait 5 minutes? Okay, questions. And you can disagree, please. Okay. I was also going to discuss, and I'd like us to consider this, Hindu ethics. And I'm going to propose, and I'd like you to meditate on this if I can ask you that, today's meditation. I'm going to suggest we need a transcendental ethics, not a transcendence of ethics. We need to try, and there are some very interesting developments in the outside world regarding ethics. It's called caring ethics, some feminist ethics, which is very interesting, and something called relationship ethics. And I'm going to suggest that actually we start to develop a proper code of ethics. In other words, it's there in Srila Prabhupada's books, it's there in the Vedas, in the Vaishnav teachings, but we need to systemize it for the modern world and to understand, so that we can actually... Otherwise, how do we respond to ethical issues? How do we respond to metaphysical issues? I know what we do most of the time, and even in ISKCON, we have that tendency, I call it personal opinion backed by Shastra. Personal opinion backed by Shastra. One needs to be careful of that. It's easily done. We need to start thinking, what is the Hindu or the Vedic or the Vaishnava approach to ethics? Very, very important. How do we respond? And do we need to be ethical? I would suggest that if we actually climb up the yoga ladder, and of course, particularly with karma yoga, the idea of dharma, which is often equated with ethics, although it's not exactly the same, is there. If we climb up the yoga ladder and we're really interested in just the top rung, and we're so interested in the top rung that we think, I'll smash the bottom one, I'll smash the second one, I'll smash the third one, the ladder will break. We need to understand that if we practice karma yoga, jnana yoga, astanga yoga, and we don't enter into that eternal relationship with Krishna, because the soul will not be satisfied fully, fall down. One will tend to fall down very easily. However, we need to be very, very careful, and particularly when it comes to morality, we should not prematurely think that I am above morality. That my morality, when I'm with devotees, Vaishnavas, then I practice nicely, I come to Bangladesh, da 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 da, and then I leave that door at 9:30 and something else goes on. That is not Acharya. That is not one who sets the example. And Srila Prabhupada writes, and we're talking metaphysics, but metaphysics is important, but it's not going to be alone what actually spreads this Krishna consciousness movement. Srila Prabhupada says it will be by our conduct and our character. And we need, I would suggest, to start engaging deliberately and consciously with virtue. We have this idea, Srila Prabhupada used the phrase, that it comes automatically. And we've got whole verses about getting all the qualities of the demigods. I'd like to discuss it, but I don't have time, because I think we've got something wrong there. And I'd like to discuss it. It's a true verse, but we've misinterpreted it. Please, could we start to look at virtue and character for our own spiritual development? And also, there are a lot of people in the outside world. I know we sometimes say they have four propensities, but that refers to the animals, actually. And in Kali Yuga, a lot of people are like animals. True. But there are a lot of people who are interested in moral issues. I know a lot of people who are genuinely interested in moral issues out there. Can we connect to them meaningfully in a way that will be relevant to their lives? Because this, it's mentioned here, I haven't had time to discuss. We're true to our sampradaya, but we need that realization. By the way, this idea of tattvadarshi, of seeing the truth, is a very powerful philosophical point that is not there in Western philosophy or in Western education. It can make a great contribution to these fields. Tattvadarshi, that direct perception of the truth. So we need to actually think on these issues and become exemplary in all worthy fields of human endeavor. Everything must go on, the chanting and so on. And of course, that relationship with Krishna is very much part of our morality. But that morality is also mediated through devotees. and even our interactions with the world to some degree. My request to you, think about these things. If anyone's interested to speak to me about it, I'd be happy to discuss it, because I think it's a project that we need to take on, because we need to show the validity of the Vedic philosophy to the Western world. Radhakrishnan did it. Dr. Radhakrishnan, Teacher's Day, 5th of September. The problem was, he's glorified. One academic told me, he wasn't that great, he said. He used a lot of references, but he was more or less name-dropping, one academic told me. The challenge with Dr. Radhakrishnan, even though he's credited, and he had, obviously, there's some benefit, we have to give credit where credit's due, is that actually he propounded the monistic philosophy as being compatible with Western philosophy, and therefore in the West, they have this idea that the Hindu tradition, the pinnacle of Hindu philosophy, is monism. Now, many academics are recognizing this. I was at a meeting, just to finish, at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, where there was one Sanskrit professor there. He was the head of Sanskrit in Oxford. And one other academic, it was a lunch, he said, and of course the problem is that actually most academics represent Hinduism as being Advaita. And this gentleman, who was very English, said, not here in Oxford, we don't. So it's being recognized that actually this personalistic philosophy is very, very valuable. And I think personally it has a lot to offer the world. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Gaura Premanandi. Hare Krishna.